Our brethren will find an extract of the law of this state relative to free people of color on another page of this paper. Great care should be taken on this point. The saints must shun every appearance of evil. As to slaves, we have nothing to say. In connection with the wonderful events of this age, much is doing towards abolishing slavery and colonizing the blacks in Africa. W.W. Phelps, 1832.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
The land of Zion, flowing with milk and honey. The vision that Joseph Smith had for Zion, identified as Jackson County, Missouri, was very potent. It fired the imagination of Mormons, spurring them to leave their homes and families to gather, while Kirtland remained the headquarters because Joseph Smith oddly did not, you know, go to Zion. Zion was still Zion. People trekked there, arriving at what was then the end of white civilization. They slowly built houses and established several communities in the fertile lands. So by the fall of 1832, there were about 800 Mormons living there, but tensions began to grow. By late 1833, just 2 years after arriving in the area, Mormons were forced out at point of bayonet. What happened? Where are you at, Zion?
I had a vision plain and true. Saw something that few people do. Lord God, I think I've seen enough.
We've covered some of the beginnings of Mormons in Missouri. So if you remember, four missionaries were called by Revelation to travel to Zion. But along the way, their more effective missionary work in Kirtland resulted in a gathering spot being established there rather than Missouri. Then, in Missouri, they ended up getting booted from Indian territory and started resorting to just preaching to white settlers there. They made just 10 converts initially, but then they relied on Mormons moving from the east to build the settlement. And life in Missouri was pretty Mormony. We talked in the Bad Girls episode about the rampant charismatic experiences going on there. It was just a little more groovy when you're on the frontier. And the conflicts? Well, those actually began from within.
I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes. Looking down from the train through those busted window panes. They were calling out my name, boy, you're next.
Edward Partridge was appointed to oversee things in the outpost. Early on, this guy butted heads with Joseph Smith, and disagreements over land in Zion festered, and eventually, meeting minutes from March 1832 indicated that Partridge had, quote, insulted the Lord's prophet in particular and assumed authority over him in open violation of the laws of God, end quote. The nerve. So Partridge apologized, being the good Mormon that he was, but that was not the end of their being salty to each other. Oh, no. So previous efforts to implement this law of consecration, there had gone, well, okay, just about as good as consecration ever goes, not well. In November 1832, Joseph Smith wrote a letter to W.W. Phelps in Missouri, and he commented on things there. Oh, and he inspired about a billion prophets. and set in motion some murders, you know, totally normal things.
This letter is really important because of one key idea, the one mighty and strong. As the only person on earth possessing a shirt proclaiming them to be the one mighty and strong, I feel like I'm uniquely qualified to comment on this. The combination of trying to implement consecration, combined with the difficulties of communicating via letters, talked about this, over hundreds of miles led to some snags. So in the version of this letter that was copying into his official letter book, Joseph Smith, actually, interestingly, in his own handwriting rather than a scribe, declares, quote, "It shall come to pass that I, the Lord God, will send one mighty and strong," close quote. Why? Well, this one would need to, quote, "set in order the house of God and to arrange by lot the inheritances of the saints," close quote. As for the dude trying to study the ark in the face of what Joseph Smith felt was clear and unmistakable instructions, well, he would, quote, "fall by the shaft of death like as a tree that is smitten by the vivid shaft of lightning," close quote. Yikes. Now, Oliver Cowdery the following year clarified that Joseph Smith's words, quote, "does not mean that anyone had at the time, but it was given for a caution to those in high standing to beware," close quote. Right, yeah. Nothing to do with Edward Partridge. So if you read the history of their interactions, Oliver's line of reasoning is very difficult to buy. Now, don't worry, later generations would come up with a zillion different options to choose from as to who is the one mighty and strong. We just might even talk about some of them later on. However, and this is important, if you ever find yourself wondering who it is, just remember, do they have the t-shirt? You don't even have to ask him to shake hands. Just look for the shirt. Very simple.
Okay, are you trying to tell me that this idea of one mighty and strong, all these prophets I've met, all of these guys, prophets are a dime a dozen in the business that I'm in. I've met a bunch of fundamentalists, one mighty and strong, or heard a lot of interesting theories. You're trying to tell me this is all about a land fight with Edward Partridge?
Really weird. And I imagine if you could sit Irvel LeBaron down, you know, just before he was throwing Molotov cocktails or gunning people down or, you know, all of his nonsense, I'd be willing to bet he probably wouldn't pin it back to Edward Partridge. So, yeah.
Well, this is what happens when men fight with a bishop, I guess.
Town like it's holy land. You got good looking friends, y'all sharp dressed men. Been getting big, making me look small. It don't matter to me, cause I'm a 10 feet, I'm 10 feet tall.
Sunstoners, this is Christopher C. Smith back to broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico to talk about the Grand Tour to the Missouri in 1831. We have talked on the podcast before about the very first Mormon missionaries who went to Missouri in 1830. And chose the site of the New Jerusalem. And today, Lindsay and Brian are going to tell you about the famous March of Zion's Camp to Missouri in 1834. But in between those two was another trip to Zion that you may not have heard of. It happened in 1831, and Ezra Booth, who went along on, for the trip, called it the Grand Tour to the Missouri. The scene was Kirtland, Ohio in June 1831. Oliver Cowdery was still off in Missouri doing missionary work, and he'd been sending optimistic letters back home about the prospects of building up the New Jerusalem and converting the Indians. General Conference had just ended in Kirtland, and Joseph Smith decided that it was time that he went and saw Zion for himself. So he received a revelation that commanded 28 elders to travel to Missouri. One of the elders selected for the journey was Ezra Booth. Now, Booth was a big man, 6 feet tall, according to one source, with a large head and broad shoulders. And he'd been a Methodist circuit rider in Connecticut, traveling on horseback from town to town and preaching the Methodist gospel. So he had a personality sized to fit his body type. In 1824, he gave up preaching and moved to Ohio to work as a farmer. And he was a friend of the Johnson family in Hiram, Ohio, and he went with them to Kirtland, Ohio, to investigate Mormonism. He'd heard rumors of the Mormon church, and so the Johnsons and Booth visited Kirtland. And while at Kirtland, Elsa Johnson had an attack of rheumatism that basically paralyzed her arm. And Joseph Smith laid his hands on her and rebuked the illness, and she was immediately healed and able to raise her arm. Booth was so impressed by this healing that he became an enthusiastic convert to Mormonism. But Booth was always a very smart guy. He was a critical thinker. And so he very quickly started to notice some problems with his new religion. And so by the end of the year, 1831, he would leave the church and publish a series of 9 letters exposing the Mormon church, one of the earliest and sort of most powerful exposés of Mormonism during this period. The grand tour to the Missouri would be a big factor in his apostasy. The grand tour was problematic from the moment that Joseph Smith received this revelation commanding 28 elders to go. According to Booth, the revelation told the elders to go to Missouri on foot, traveling 2 by 2, except for Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, Martin Harris, and Edward Partridge, who were told to go by carriage and steamboat. The leaders took plenty of money with them on their journey, and they dressed like fine gentlemen on their steamboat, while the rest of these elders are walking with packs on their back with little or no money, looking like hobos. And according to Booth, when the little money they took with them on the journey was expended, they subsisted by begging until they arrived to their journey's end. This inequality really rankled Ezra Booth. The idea that the Lord's chosen would basically beg for a living rankled him a lot. But after some initial hesitation, he decided to fully commit himself to the work he threw himself in, and he marched to Missouri, preaching in settlements along the way. Now, for Joseph Smith, as well as Ezra Booth, the whole journey was really disappointing. Smith stopped in Cincinnati to talk to the famous Campbellite preacher Walter Scott. But Scott wasn't interested in Mormonism. He was unswayed by the Mormons' attempts to proselytize him. And so they went on, and in St. Louis, they couldn't find transportation to Independence, so they had to walk the final 250 miles of the journey. And Joseph Smith preached along the way, but nobody in Missouri seemed to be particularly interested in Mormonism. On reaching Jackson County, he found a ragged collection of about 20 log cabins occupied mostly by drunks and thieves. It was rough and tumble frontier. It was a brand new town. And even the local Christian preachers were heavy drinkers. To make matters worse, Oliver Cowdery's letters had exaggerated his missionary success, and only a handful of people had converted to Mormonism. Ezra Booth had a very similar experience on the journey. He had expected to feel the Spirit. The further west he traveled, he'd feel the Spirit more. But everywhere that he preached, he got a cold reception. If anything, it was the opposite. The further west he went, it seemed like people were less interested in what he had to say. And he was just as disappointed as Joseph when he saw Independence, Missouri. He wrote, "We expected to find a large church, which Smith had said before we left, was revealed to him in a vision that Oliver had raised up there. This large church was found to consist of 3 or 4 females." A little bit of sexism there, looking upon females as less valuable church members than males. But the point being, they expected, Joseph Smith had promised that there would be a big church there, and in fact there were only 3 or 4 members. Ezra was even more disappointed in his fellow elders than he was in the size of the church there. When he set out for Missouri, he was led to expect that a door would be open for missionary work among the Jackson County settlers and the Indians. Before leaving, several people were ordained to the gift of tongues and told that they would be able to miraculously communicate with the Indians in their own languages. But when they arrived, they found out that it was illegal for them to preach to the Indians. Worse, none of the elders even seemed particularly interested in preaching. They tried to perform a few miracles, but their attempts failed, which they blamed on a lack of faith in the local people. So Ezra is very disappointed in his fellow elders and their enthusiasm for this mission that they've gone on. Booth had also expected, Joseph Smith had led him to expect to assemble together in conference according to commandment, and the Lord would signally display his power for the confirmation of our faith. But we commenced our journey home before most of the elders even arrived. It is true a conference was held, but it was considered so unimportant that myself and another man were permitted to be absent for the purpose of procuring the means of conveyance down the river. He had expected to see the foundation of the city and the temple laid. And this he was permitted to see, and it was in fact a curiosity, but not worth going to Missouri to witness, he felt. In effect, he just found the whole experience really underwhelming, and it felt like a waste of his time. In Joseph Smith's history, there's this description of the land around Jackson County that was penned during this expedition. It makes it sound really beautiful. It describes a sea of meadows decorated with a growth of flowers. It had rich soil from 3 to 10 feet deep that could be used for farming. The animals on the prairie seem nearly to raise themselves without the need for human labor. And historian Richard Bushman cites this description as evidence that Joseph got over his initial disappointment and changed his perspective on Jackson County. According to Bushman, he sounded like Moses looking on Canaan. The problem with that interpretation is that Joseph didn't write this statement. Sidney Rigdon did, and he wrote it as a publicity piece to raise money. In fact, Joseph had received a revelation commanding Sidney to write it specifically for that purpose. The revelation says, "Behold, I give unto my servant Sidney a commandment, that he shall write a description of the land of Zion, and a statement of the will of God, as it shall be made known to him by the Spirit, and a subscription to be presented to the churches to obtain money to purchase lands for an inheritance of the children of God. For behold, the Lord willeth that his disciples and the children of men should open their hearts to purchase this whole region of country, lest they receive none inheritance save it be by the shedding of blood." Booth found this revelation both disturbing and hilarious. The Mormons were supposed to buy up all the land in order to save themselves the trouble of shedding the Missourians' blood? What the heck? Not only was this weirdly violent, but it was also just not going to happen. The Mormons were so poor, Booth pointed out, there's no way they would be able to purchase all of the lands in Jackson County, Missouri. This was just an unrealistic commandment. The evidence that Joseph Smith didn't get over his initial disappointment in the new Zion, as Bushman suggests, is that he went back to Kirtland and stayed there. As Booth wrote, before they went to Missouri, Joseph Smith's language was, "We shall winter in Ohio but one winter more," before moving to Jackson County. But once they got to Missouri, Joseph changed his tune and declared that it will be many years before we come here, for the Lord has a great work for us to do in Ohio, and the great work is to make a thorough alteration of the Bible and invent new revelations, this is Booth paraphrasing, and these are to be sent to Missouri in order to be printed. Booth quipped that Smith could save on postage if he did the great work in Missouri rather than Ohio, but Smith preferred to do the great work in Ohio, apparently. And for Ezra Booth, Joseph Smith's decision to stay in Ohio while other people worked to build up Zion was motivated essentially by laziness. The leaders, Booth said, found it much easier and better suited to their dispositions to write commandments in Kirtland than to gain a livelihood by the sweat of their brow in Missouri, and indeed, Smith has commanded himself not to labor, and by his mandate has enjoined it upon the church to support him financially. Bishop Edward Partridge, when we were in Missouri, intimated that Smith and others were much too inclined to laziness. Smith replied, "I am commanded not to labor." So much for the New Jerusalem and the grand tour to the Missouri. Ezra Booth left the church by the end of the year.
Well, you walk around this town like it's holy land. You got good-looking friends, y'all sharp-dressed men. Been getting big, making me look small. It don't matter to me, because I'm a 10 feet, I'm 10 feet tall.
And now, back to Edward Partridge, Missouri, yeah, and the One Mighty and Strong. The boys aren't getting along. While these internal conflicts were simmering, external pressures were about to get ugly. Like Diet Pepsi ugly. In the July 1833 issue of the Church's periodical in Independence, the Evening and Morning Star, editor W.W. Phelps published a long letter to the elders. As part of this, he noted, quote, "Our brethren will find an extract of the law of the state relative to free people of color on another page of this paper. Great care should be taken on this point. The saints must shun every appearance of evil. As to slaves, we have nothing to say in connection with the wonderful events of this age. Much is doing towards abolishing slavery and colonizing the blacks in Africa."
Yeah, if you found that statement a little hard to follow, you're not alone. W.W. Phelps thought he was the world's greatest writer, but sometimes it's a little tricky to untangle what he's saying.
I can't tell whose team he's on. Which direction is he fighting? Against slavery or for it? I mean, I feel like it matters, especially to a lot of the One Mighty and Strong guys. Like, if we could get that sorted out, maybe Mormon fundamentalism would be a little bit less racist. Did you catch it in his statement? Abolitionism. Wonderful events. Remember, Missouri equals a slave state. So Mormons were already suspect. They believed the land was given to them. They usually voted in block. And now, supporting abolition? Hard nope. The reaction was so quick and severe that Phelps issued an extra by the middle of July. In it, he tried to execute a complete pivot on his earlier words, saying, quote, "To be short, we are opposed to have free people of color admitted into the state, and we say that none will be admitted into the church for we are determined to obey the laws and constitution of our country. I mean, are we? Are we determined to obey the laws? And which laws? Ugh. Didn't really work. Things stayed ugly. 2 days after the extra, a group listed their beefs with the Mormons. The initial deal was that they would buy them out, but, you know, that requires cash.
On July 20th, they presented an ultimatum to Mormon leaders, and they turned them down. Picture this event. So the group gathers at the courthouse, they take a vote. It's very democratic of them. And then it's time for smashy smashy. Here's where we get our famous scene of where they go in, they destroy the print shop, scatter the pages in the street for the in-progress Book of Commandments. If you think back to our History of Scriptures episodes, there where the Rollins sisters go grab the pages and then hide in the cornfield, the mob warns the Mormons there that they would return in a couple days just in case their message wasn't already clear. So 3 days after Smash Brothers, they reach an agreement whereby all Mormons have to leave the county by April 1834. Well, that's it for Zion. Blzzt, no dice. Come on now, you know better. So Joseph Smith writes a letter the next month in August, and instructs them to rebuild the print shop and get printing the Evening and Morning Star again. And, just in case dudes in Missouri were unclear how strong a stand Joseph Smith intended to take, he thundered, quote, "It is the will of the Lord that the store should be kept and that not one foot of land purchased should be given to the enemies of God," close quote. All right, then. Now, think about it. This is all well and good to say hundreds of miles away with no danger to you present. Speaking of things that are easier to say at a distance, he also told him, quote, "The harder the persecution, the greater the gifts of God upon his church," close quote. That's a good statement for a Mormon wall somewhere, right? Not really the most welcome thing to hear when you're standing outside your house that's just been destroyed.
In case you're wondering if Joseph Smith said other things that would prove to be very unhelpful, he absolutely did. I think we live with those impacts all the time when he said something, you know, who knows, maybe he was having a bad day, maybe he fell in the water and got upset, and then he cursed the waters, and now, you know, centuries later, we have kids that aren't allowed to swim on Sundays. So thanks for that. This letter, he adds some more of that. He also told the Missouri folks to, quote, "make a show as if they were leaving, but to wait on God to be gracious and call on him without ceasing to make bare his arm for our defense." If you're keeping score, this strategy really, really stunk during Missouri. It also didn't do so hot in the 1880s when the federal government sort of bends the Mormons' arm behind their back until they said uncle. So maybe there's a better way. Actually, the ending of the letter hinted at the next phase of action. Quote, "We wait the command of God to do whatever he please, and if he shall go up to Zion and defend the brethren by the sword, we fly and we count not our lives dear to us." Now there's some foreshadowing.
So per the terms of the agreement, Mormons started moving north across the river to Clay County. The Missouri governor had expressed some intention early on to help Mormons regain their land, but it was pretty limited, and it didn't really involve using state troops to protect them. Mormons tried the, quote, "use your words" approach, so popular with parents, writing both to the governor and the president. Andrew Jackson, remember, the guy who wasn't going to be on the 20, except he still really is. So the petitions to both of these guys had about as much effect as you can imagine. In the meantime, a few families started going back to Jackson County and got the business end of whips and sticks in return. Because the snail mail was so snaily, leaders in Kirtland were kind of slow to learn about these developments. So they're writing them a letter, "Hey, how you guys doing? Can, you know, or how are things going?" And they're in the middle of getting destroyed. So once they finally get the word to headquarters, they convene the Justice League, which you probably know better as the High Council.
But you can imagine the sort of tenseness that they feel. When I look back at this time, I see them almost as like, you know, boys in a clubhouse getting their sticks and knives together, like, "they're out to get us, let's go get the monster." Like, that's kind of the temperature of the room. And we kind of already had a hint of what was going to happen. Trouble was brewing. A December 1833 revelation started talking about warriors. And not the Steph Curry and Clay Thompson kind, but like regular Mormon dudes. More like stripling, but with Bowie knives. At the High Council meeting 2 months later, they decide to gather a group and go back and redeem Zion. Now, redeeming Zion sounds nice in theory. I don't think that redeem is sort of the Jesus resurrection kind. A revelation that same day, now DNC 103, addressed to the Lord's friends, indicated that everything had gone according to plan and that the bad guys in Missouri had been suffered, quote, suffered by God, so that they, quote, might fill up the measure of their iniquities, that their cup might be full, and that those who call themselves after my name might be chastened for a little season, end quote, since they hadn't listened to the commandments. No worries, however, because, quote, they shall, for I have decreed it, begin to prevail against mine enemies from this very hour. Wait up, though. Only if, and this is the key, they had all had to observe all the Lord's words for this to happen. What's that? You don't think they were going to observe all the Lord's words? All of those many, many, many commandments that didn't contradict each other? Such a lack of faith.
Yeah, one more hitch, too. The saints were told that they couldn't, quote, pollute their inheritances, close quote, if they wanted to prevail in Missouri. What does that even mean? It's a great question. Moving on. It was time for a good old-fashioned Old Testament pep talk. So they were told that, quote, a man who shall lead them like as Moses, close quote, would be raised up, and that they, ta-da, they were the warriors from the earlier revelation. Never underestimate the allure of being a warrior. Not even the Kevin Durants among us can resist it. So this revelation brings up the idea of avenging God of his enemies. This concept later takes on a lot more force after Joseph and Hiram are killed, and Mormons then covenant to avenge their blood. With the motivation portion of the revelation taken care of, it was time for Mormon Voltron to assemble. The revelation started high with 500 men required, but the Lord, he's a practical guy. Quote, men do not always do my will. Therefore, if you cannot obtain 500, seek diligently that peradventure you may obtain 3. And if you cannot obtain 300, seek diligently that peradventure you may obtain 100. But verily I say unto you, a commandment I give unto you, that you shall not go up unto the land of Zion until you have obtained 100 of the strength of my house.
They actually didn't do too bad. Recruiters fanned out, and eventually more than 200 folks are part of the expedition. People are catching on. There's nothing to codify someone like the threat of violence. Joseph Smith had to get some things squared away first. So by the 1st of May, the first group leaves Kirtland, and a few days later, Joseph Smith's group leaves to meet up with them. They walked as much as 30 miles a day. Given the lack of Dr. Scholl's inserts in the 1830s, they soon ended up with blisters and bloody feet. And as Mormons, we love blisters and bloody feet. Love them. And even though we love them in our pioneer and ancestor stories, in real life, they're not quite as fun. So 2 weeks in, Sylvester Smith, we mentioned him earlier, quote, lost the spirit of peace and called another dude an old jackass. He said a naughty word. That is a sick vintage burn there. Joseph Smith stepped in, and then Sylvester, who has no relation to Joseph Smith, by the way, said he wasn't afraid of Joseph. Uh-oh. Now we've crossed the line. We've had all these revelations about one mighty and strong and people like unto Moses, and I'd be a little afraid of that. The prophet warned them that this kind of nonsense would lead to, quote, misfortunes, difficulties, and hindrances. Next morning, the horses can't walk. Immediate repentance led to the horses getting the spring back in their step. Imagine that. Except for Sylvester Smith's horse, who then dies. Apparently, quote, we believe that horses will be punished for their own sins is not a thing. Sorry, horstery.
In an era where you have zero seasons of Stranger Things to binge, a group of Mormons wandering through your random town, it's a big deal. There is a fantastic newspaper report of the group wandering through, quote, with the Book of Mormon in one hand and a musket in the other, close quote. As they're marching, the Book of Mormon is definitely on their mind during the trek. In a letter that he writes back to Emma, Joseph noted that they were, quote, wandering over the plains of the Nephites, recounting occasionally the history of the Book of Mormon, roving over the mounds of that once beloved people of the Lord, picking up their skulls and their bones as a proof of its divine authenticity, close quote. Not surprisingly, the day before the letter, they actually had found a skeleton. According to the Journal of Reuben Miller in the camp, Joseph Smith indicated, quote, his name was Zelph, a warrior under the prophet Onondagas, Zelph, a white Lamanite, and that, quote, he was killed in battle, said he was a man of God and the curse was taken off, or in part, he was a white Lamanite, was known from the Atlantic to the Rocky Mountains, close quote. That's all well and good, but another diary indicates that Zelph was from 8 to 9 feet tall. Now that's a Lamanite I can respect right there. Wilford Woodruff later wrote about this episode and added that he took some of his leg bones to Missouri, where he wanted to bury them on the temple site. Now that's a story for you. The arrow that was supposed to have killed Zelph, when he went to the great shelf in the sky, was then given to Wilford's wife, Emma.
It wasn't all fun and Lamanites, though. George A. Smith, Joseph's younger cousin and future wig-wearing apostle, remembered being so tired that he, quote, dreamed while walking along the road of seeing a beautiful stream of water by a pleasant shade and a nice loaf of bread and a bottle of milk laid out on a cloth by the side of the spring, end quote. I feel like this is where Fabio shows up on a horse. Now remember, as we've pointed out before, George A. Smith seemed to feel that the exaggeration or even complete bullcrap were part of his calling as an apostle. It's kind of his brand. Other people in the camp report that they eat okay during the march, so maybe George A. Smith was just living his Kanye life right there. I don't know what's going on. Camp disputes continued, though, and it seemed like people were becoming more and more unhappy. Sylvester Smith made another cameo as villain when he said if Joseph Smith's dog bit him, he would kill it. What, pray tell you, could be a proper answer in this time of honor culture to come at the prophet's dog? Like, the prophet's one thing, but you come after his dog. Yeah, how's Joseph Smith gonna, like, you come at the honor of him, but now his dog? He basically responds, and here's the gist, I'm not being reductive at all. I'll beat the crap out of you if you kill my dog. You know what's revealing about this episode? It's a late addition to the history of the church, and when it's told there, it becomes a moral lesson where Joseph Smith is modeling how dumb Sylvester's behavior is, how wicked and foolhardy. My guess is it happened and Joseph Smith just lost his temper.
So while they're en route, the Missouri leaders write a letter to Missouri Governor Daniel Dunklin asking to get him to go on his promise of giving them some health. Not surprisingly, Dunklin writes back at this point saying, guys, I'd love to help you, but what if you guys just hug it out with the Jackson County guys and maybe leave me out of it? Dunklin says in principle, Mormons can do whatever they want. Want to believe Joseph Smith is, quote, the only true and living God? Go for it. Quote, call their habitation Zion? Awesome, bro. Knock yourself out. In principle. Then, in a phrase sure to piss off all Mormons, he went on to say that it just wasn't in his line of work to personally step in. Here's the thing. Mormons insisted that people act on ideals, not on realities. No matter how much you want the governor to step in, or even how much you think the governor should step in, you know what? He's probably not going to. Guess what? In the 1870s and 80s, no matter if you think the federal government should rule that polygamy is cool just on its merits alone, no matter all the mail they're getting there from their constituents, they're not going to do it. 19th century Mormons usually sucked at reading the room.
At any rate, the train kept a-rolling on down to San Antone, or Missouri, as the case may be. They picked up a few people along the way and beefed up their numbers to more than 200. During this period, you can really see the appeal to the inner 9-year-old of each of these dudes. They get to have sword practice, target practice, persecution complex, and generally just play army buster style. But as you may have heard, Mormons kind of sucked at reading the room. Joseph Smith dispatches Orson Hyde and Parley Pratt to go check in on Governor Dunklin to see if he's ready to man up and get back on their Jackson County lands. It seems that the governor had actually given some indication he might call up the militia to help them. So to recap at this point, Dunklin is a parent who's promised something to their kids without really thinking through how it will actually happen. Dunklin has now moved on to, you know, running the state. Dunklin does write to the head of the militia in Zion and tells him to give the Mormons back their guns. Right.
By now, the camp is actually in Missouri and they're getting close to their destination. This is the point where, you probably heard this, the dramatic story of the mob, they come after him, but hail halts their progress in miraculous fashion. In basically a complete lack of contemporary records, it's tough to say what we make of this event. John Whitmer, who admittedly was not part of the camp, does report the episode just a few years later, as does Heber C. Kimball, whose story basically becomes the official narrative of the march. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that it probably got exaggerated over time. Something that is definitely more certain is that they have a revelation that comes in the middle of all this. On June 22nd, Joseph Smith dictates a very interesting text. If you read it, you can already see that this expedition has become a watershed moment.
This is kind of hard, though, to beat because they're already talking extreme violence, conspiracies, army tactics, finding magical bones of white, tall Native Americans in the ground. Lots of magic, lots of conspiracies, probably lots of dreaming of their lady back at home. Okay, so what does this revelation say when everything's so hard? It basically says, you tried hard, guys. I got you from here on out. The Lord says he's going to fight the battles. However, it's not time to throw the towel in just yet. They are told to hold tight and try again in the future. Jackson County will be a conflicted heritage in the future. The revelation is included in the 1844 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants, but with code names Barak Ale, which is Joseph Smith, and Benimi, which means elders. What's that about, Brian?
So starting in 1836, Joseph and other guys in Kirtland do a Hebrew school, and they have lots of fun with it. It's got all this mystical elements of ancient languages and sacred texts, and it creeps into all sorts of things they do. It's where we get our word Nauvoo, and it's where we get our code names here. So kind of a fun little tidbit.
Anyway, back to cool club code names in the Zion's Camp treehouse. Barak Ale, Joseph Smith, and the Benimi, the elders, will hold back, gather their strength, and then throw down the enemy's towers, scatter their watchmen, and avenge the Lord of his enemies. I don't mean to make light of those words, but it sounds so tough. Like, such tough guys. Look at them. Boys only allowed. It's actually Olive Church. Okay. Yeah, nothing aggressive about any of this. I love that they use code names for this because no one, especially Gentiles, could ever figure out what was going on here. Barak Ale, Benimi?
And we see this nonsense again later. Occasionally, when the Council of 50 is organized, journal accounts will spell 50 backwards because that is an unbreakable code. Like, I don't care what sort of code talkers you've got going on. They'll never figure that out. Same thing here. Oh, this is a weird name. I apparently it's not the Mormons after all. It must be someone else we don't interact with.
How will we ever know what's happening? What is so fascinating is that in the 1841 revelation, also included in that DNC edition, releases the Mormons from their obligation to Jackson County, which it used to be so important. But now the Lord says, quote, when I give a commandment unto any of the sons of men to do a work unto my name, and those sons of men go with all their might and with all they have to perform that work and cease not their diligence and their enemies come upon them and hinder them from performing the work, behold, it behooveth me to require that work no more at the hands of those sons of men, but to accept of their offering.
Well, Mormons would never try again to do something integral to their identity only to be stopped by the government, right? Nothing. Definitely not a variant system of marriage frowned on by society. Now, guess what revelation would be used as part of the explanation for Wilford Woodruff's 1890 manifesto? Yep, the one Lindsay just read. In the October 1890 conference where the manifest was presented, George Cannon reads that verse and then declared, quote, it is on this basis that President Woodruff has felt himself justified in issuing this manifesto, close quote. Guessing this rationale is probably not super well looked upon by some of our friends. We'll talk about that. Spoiler alert, it was 100% more complicated than that. Complicated enough to justify an episode? You bet your sweet bippy. It's interesting that this rationale, with its origins in the failure to reclaim Jackson County lands, would be part of numerous LDS explanations as to why polygamy also was abandoned. Not that either of us here have any thoughts on this subject.
Listen, I don't mean to make light of the violence, but looking back on my ancestors and the stories I was told, it's just so hard for me to take this seriously. Because this is the root of the persecution complex. This is the root of some doctrine that I think is actually super, super harmful. Not just in the LDS church context, because remember when we're talking about this, these revelations are being used by all these 487 breakoff, expressions of Mormonism elsewhere. They take this stuff and they make sense. So if you're interpreting this from an emotional maturity level of a bunch of kids in a treehouse fighting against imagined enemies, that's how people are going to read it. And that's unfortunately how we've seen a lot of fundamentalist men sort of read this stuff. So I guess I'm just irritated that it came to violence. And of course it did. You know, Mormons, when you're grabbing up power, land, and ladies, people get a little nervous. So with that fun thought, the ride comes to an end. Some dudes are called back to Kirtland for an endowment of power, and the rest wander on. A cholera outbreak soon puts the final sad punctuation on the expedition. Among the 13 who died were Jesse Smith, Joseph Smith's cousin, and Betsy Parrish. Yeah, you heard me. Betsy. Did you know women marched with the camp? Oh, maybe girls were allowed in the treehouse after all. Have you ever heard anything about these women? Somewhere around a dozen women and a dozen children were part of the expedition. One of them, Jane Clark, contributed $50 to the camp fund, one of the largest donations. The women clearly shared the memories and status and attended the reunions in Utah later on. Betsy's death actually proved very helpful in identifying the burial site of some of the cholera victims. When skeletons were found in the area where they were recorded to have been interred, one found to be a woman about Betsy's age, since only one woman was known to have died. Betsy was the key to the identification. Because the spirit of Anita Stansfield just can't leave us alone, there was even a marriage that grew out of the march. What a romantic story. Charlotte Alvord seems to have been involved in the making of Goo Goo Eyes with another member of the camp, and they were married soon after the expedition disbanded. So for all you Mormons out there who met your spouse on your mission, take that. Did you meet them on an expedition to Zion's Camp?
Who knew the love in the time of cholera was about Zion's Camp? That's a new one on me. In the last 20 years or so, it's become pretty much the routine to paint the march as a total failure, with these cholera deaths as kind of the morbid frosting on top. Now, since we need to keep up our image here, we're going to revise history just a bit. So current research, largely growing out of the Joseph Smith papers, helps us to understand that the lack of promised help from the Missouri militia was really a major factor for why nothing happened toward resolving this Jackson County situation. Now, that being said, it's tough to argue with the scoreboard. Number of Jackson County properties reacquired? Big fat zero. Number of people identified as either loyalists or filthy apostates? Quite a few. You might remember that 3/4 of the apostles selected the following year come out of this expedition, notably Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball. On the other side, Sylvester Smith, despite some pretty reasonable complaints, ends up getting brought before the High Council and gets 99% excommunicated, but at the last second confesses and then actually is added to the First Council of 70 in 1835. But Jackson County would forever loom large in Mormon memory. This idea of going back has really never left the shared consciousness and probably never will. We certainly plan about talking about it again.
Yeah, I mean, how many of you grew up with some iteration as a Mormon of going back to Jackson County? In fact, when the prepper movement was at its height in Utah, I kid you not, I'm not making this up, I have a photo of it. I was walking to a local strip mall in like Sandy, Utah, I can't remember, West Jordan or something, and they had an aluminum handcart that you could buy so you could take back your things to Jackson County, Missouri.
No green wood in that one. That's a nice thought.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
William Miller predicted the timing of the Second Coming a few times. After the last one in 1844 didn't happen, his followers were very disenchanted, an event historians now call the Great Disappointment. Are you ready for tonight's Great Disappointment? There will be no Books of Mormon report. Instead, it's the Articles of Mormon's report. There's still really no good scholarly study of the expulsion from Jackson County and then the Camp of Israel march. Matt Godfrey's article, The Redemption of Zion Must Needs Come by Power, Insights into the Camp of Israel Expedition 1834, published in BYU Studies, is really a good step towards a solid history of the group. Notice, I just said Camp of Israel, not Zion's Camp. Matt points out in the article that Zion's Camp was not actually a contemporary term, but comes about later, and his article is full of good stuff like this. Drawing on the Joseph Smith papers, for which he's a general editor, he pulls out all sorts of interesting details. Did you know the expedition's general fund, along with what Joseph Smith kicks in, amounted to $2,200? That's more than $50,000 in current values. Check out this article sometime for an excellent overview of the camp.
Brother Young. as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.